coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. We wrap up our series of 2024 candidate conversations with an interview from the race for U.S. Senate. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our look at the U.S. Senate campaign focuses on the Democrat in the race, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester. We also learn more about the rebirth of the recently closed Creative Vision Factory in Wilmington and meet the new executive director of the Biggs Museum of American Art in Arts Playlist. Plus, Enlighten Me offers a glimpse into how the University of Delaware is using AI in classrooms this fall. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We've reached out to all candidates filed to run in the races for U.S. House and U.S. Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews you hear on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. On this show, we wrap up our candidate conversations in the race for U.S. Senate, which features three candidates seeking to replace Democrat Tom Carper, who is retiring after four terms and 24 years in the Senate. We previously heard from Republican Eric Hansen and the Independent Party of Delaware's Michael Katz. Today, we hear from the Democrat in the race, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester. She is seeking the Senate seat after serving four terms in Delaware's lone U.S. House seat. Before we jump into some of the issues, many voters in Delaware are already very familiar with you. So I'm curious, is there something you feel voters should know about you that maybe they don't know about you?
Yeah. Oh, well, first of all, I don't know if there's a lot people don't know about me because I talk a lot, you know, and we try to make sure we communicate a lot as well. But I think one thing from my time in the House that I think a lot of people don't probably know is that we had this theme. When Lisa goes to Washington, I yell it out to the audience and they yell back, we all go to Washington. And so a lot of people might not realize that in my tenure in the House, I made it a point to be in multiple caucuses at multiple tables representing Delaware. So, for example, I'm in the Progressive Caucus, but I'm also in the New Dems, which is our business-friendly caucus, because I said to both groups, if you take Delaware, you take all of us. I'm in the Women's Caucus. I'm in the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm an assistant whip. I also am in the Chicken Caucus. I'm also in the Pork Caucus. The Firefighter Caucus. And part of it for me was to be able to lend our voice to all of these tables and be representative of Delaware. And then I think the second thing a lot of people, some people might not know, but it's probably one of the most exciting things to me lately, the best title I've ever gotten, I got last year, which is grandmother. And so I have a granddaughter and I am elated. She brings me so much joy. She brings me bright hope as well right now. And she's an inspiration for the work that I'm doing.
So let's talk a little bit about the work to come, some of the issues that the country is facing. Immigration, obviously, is one of them. There was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Trump. So the basic question, would you support that bill if it was brought up again?
Yes. And I think it goes to the deeper issues of, you know, immigration was something that historically had been a bipartisan issue. And, you know, finally, President Biden, Vice President Harris, working with Republican Senate leaders, were able to come up with a compromise bill that would address our issues. We know that we want to make sure that, you know, illicit drugs aren't coming across the border. And this bill was to really help support that border enforcement. We know that, you know, we want to make sure that we are safe and that we are protected, but also that we are concerned about our workforce and opportunities to make sure our economy is still strong. And so they came up with this bipartisan legislation. And to me, what is important, Donald Trump was the one who actually sort of cut it off at the kneecap. This was an opportunity. And I always say, if you're really serious about it, then vote for it. It is my serious hope that we will be able to come to consensus and get this bill, if not this bill, a compromise across the finish line.
I was going to mention, you mentioned it was a compromise bill. Do you see this bill, if it were to pass, as a first step? Would there still be, in your mind, more to do on the immigration issue to really get where you want to go?
You know, most definitely. I mean, we have had a broken immigration system for decades now. And, you know, in order for us to be able to deal with this, we've got to make sure that we're coming together. It's my goal in the Senate to continue the work, bipartisan work that I started in the House, and to look for these kind of solutions. Because again, we're fortunate that border crossings are down now under this president. If people are really paying attention to the, you know, sort of like what's happening, because there's a lot of rhetoric out there, but this president and vice president have done a good job in that regard, but we know we still have so much more to do.
You mentioned reproductive rights earlier, so I want to talk a little bit directly about that. Following the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion left to the states, creating a patchwork of approaches and leaving questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. Should Congress step in, and if so, in what way?
This is probably the first time that I can think of that a right was actually taken away from us. It is probably one of the number one things that people approach me on in our state. Donald Trump, I'm not sure it changes from day to day, but we know you got to trust people. When he bragged about taking away this right, trust that he would do it again. We know that, you know, he has talked about punishing women. And so to me, this is one of the reasons why the Senate is important, because we need to codify Roe versus Wade. Even things like IVF, my granddaughter that I just spoke about, she would not be here if it were not for IVF. We've seen what the impacts are across the country, even on our maternal mortality, where we're a country, the only industrialized country, where the numbers are going up for maternal deaths. And it's three times worse for Black women. And so for me, this issue is one that is important, is one that we need to focus on. It's one that we need to believe people, not just by what they say, but what they have done.
In the wake of the Dobbs decision and some others recently by the Supreme Court, President Biden and others have suggested some effort to reform the court, ethics rules, term limits. What would you support in that realm?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has made some decisions, whether it's the Dobbs decision, whether it is giving immunity to a president and saying, when we believe as part of our country that rule of law, nobody's above the law. The Supreme Court has done some things recently that have, I think, diminished people's confidence in the Supreme Court. And so I think it's important, as the president has outlined, that we do have a code of conduct, code of ethics. I think that is at the minimum, a code of conduct that is not just them policing themselves is important. I also think that looking at term limits, I think the president had proposed 18 years. I think term limits are really make sense. For me, I think there are some real opportunities to, again, instill confidence in the Supreme Court, because we need that more than ever as we look at our checks and balances.
Voters consistently list the economy as a top issue. The Biden administration touts low unemployment, strong job numbers, along with some other positive economic indicators as signs the country's headed in the right direction. But inflation, higher prices for many everyday goods, things like gas, groceries, continue to leave many people still struggling. What do you feel Congress should be doing to promote economic growth and try to battle back inflation?
For me, I think the role of Congress, we have many areas that we can play. I even put forward an affordability plan as part of our campaign, because there are issues such as housing, where it's probably one of the number one issues I hear up and down the state, where affordable housing is a challenge for people. So as part of our affordability plan, I've got bipartisan legislation already that we want to continue with to really kind of cut the red tape and to get rid of zoning barriers that allow for the creation of affordable housing. There's issues like lowering the cost of goods. One of the big areas, again, bipartisan, that I've been able to work on is strengthening our supply chains. It really wasn't until the pandemic that people even paid attention to the words supply chains. But when you couldn't get PPE, when you couldn't get baby formula, lumber prices went up, so housing prices went up. When those things happened, it meant that the cost of things went up. So I've passed bipartisan legislation in the House. It is now in the Senate with two senators who are Democrat and Republican that don't always see eye to eye. And we're hoping that it's on its way to the president. But that lowers the cost of goods for people. Capping the cost of insulin for our seniors. Again, this was another incredible thing that we did as part of the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed and work that I got to work on as part of a member of the Health Subcommittee in Congress. But the reality is that's only for our seniors on Medicare. We want to make sure that everyone has those same benefits where we can cap the costs. Again, looking at every way, part of it is looking at things like price gouging, making sure that we level the playing field. To me, this is probably the top issue, is making sure we have a strong economy and building an economy for now and the future. So I've got legislation on artificial intelligence and making sure we're all literate. I've got legislation on using immersive technology to train people for the jobs of now and the future.
I want to hit a couple of foreign policy issues. We'll start with Israel and Gaza. President Biden has been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza for some time now, to no avail so far. What do you believe the U.S. approach should be in this conflict?
I think October 7th was a very dark day in history. And, you know, we continue to support the president and his efforts to bring peace to that region. We know that Israel has been not just an ally, but a friend in that region of the world. We also know that not only do they have a right to exist, but they have a right to defend themselves. And at the same time, we see the devastation and what is happening to Palestinian families and believe that humanitarian aid needs to be present, which is one of the reasons why I voted for and supported the legislation, the bipartisan legislation that I did in May. For us, it is truly supporting the president and his efforts, supporting our allies, and really seeking peace, because that right now is the most important thing. I will continue to advocate for peace, and we are, again, just prayerful, actually, for all of those families that are experiencing the trauma, the hostages, those individuals that, the children. This is one of the I think, most challenging things that we've been through in the past year. And it's not just this year. So we hope to see peace.
And another area where there is conflict, obviously, is Ukraine. That war continues. Where do you stand on continuing to support the Ukraine as it seeks to fend off the Russian invasion that is now 2.5 years old?
Well, you know, I think it is important that when we say that a friend is a friend and an ally is an ally, that we stick with that and we stand for that. And so I am grateful that I've been able to play a part in supporting Ukraine, particularly against Putin. I mean, we know he is an autocrat. We know he is a dictator. We know that for him, what he is doing really goes against the grain of, you know, self-governance and self-determination. And so I believe that we have to continue to be strong with our ally, that we also have, you know, under President Biden, I think, brought together allies from around the world, also strengthen NATO. And our support, I think, is very important. And I think it's important, too, that it be bipartisan, because this is also about the democratic ideals. It's not just about that one country. It truly is about who do we say we all are as allies and as a country. And so I would continue to support Ukraine.
I want to ask one very Senate-specific question. That is, would you back doing away with the filibuster? Why or why not?
Yes, I would. And, you know, we look at issues of the filibuster over time, you know, what it has been used for. And also when people have said, you know what, we'll put this to the side. Two areas where I felt compelled. I think it really, really also impacted my feelings about the filibuster. Were number one, the overturning, you know, of Roe, and the fact that we need to codify Roe versus Wade. The second is for me the issue of voting rights. You know, to me, if Mitch McConnell can say, let's put the filibuster aside for the debt limit, but we can't for something as basic and foundational in our country as voting rights, that doesn't make sense to me. It isn't a law. It is an antiquated rule. And to me, what I try to do, how I try to govern, is I try to work and find bipartisan solutions, because to me, those are the ones that are lasting. I feel like if something's going to hold us back from the progress of voting rights, that's not the direction I want to go. So I am for getting rid of the filibuster.
We're asking all candidates we're talking to in this election about trust in government, because it seems like this is a time where there is a stronger distrust of government and calls for more transparency and accountability. If elected, what role do you feel you could play personally and as a U.S. senator in delivering greater transparency and accountability and just generally building trust in government?
Well, you know, first of all, I think to me, even doing a program like this, I hope that it creates some hope and some confidence in the fact that there are people that are getting the job done. A lot of times the cameras don't show the work that I've been able to do in a bipartisan way on bills like Clean Slate, which, you know, if somebody served their time, low-level nonviolent offense, they should be able to have a second chance in a clean slate. We've been able to even pass it at the Delaware local level because of the leadership that, you know, I've had with my Republican colleagues on the federal level. My work on supply chains, again, bipartisan, telehealth, bipartisan. I literally can go through all kinds of legislation that we've been able to work on and been able to pass because we work together. And so I try to use every opportunity I can to talk about those things to instill confidence. I think the other piece for me is the theme of our campaign is actually Bright Hope. It was the name of the church that my grandmother attended for 70 years in Philadelphia. And to me, it's not just the name of a church. It is truly a way of being, even when things feel dark. It is my goal to bring Bright Hope to the Senate, bring that Delaware Bright Hope to the Senate.
Finally, I want to ask if there's an issue we haven't discussed that you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how you would address it if elected.
Hearing from the people, we did this Delivering for Delaware tour that we're still on. We've come out with an agriculture plan. We've come out with, you know, an affordability plan. But hearing from people, one of the things that maybe doesn't get the attention that it really needs, that, and I pass out index cards sometimes when I'm meeting with roundtables. And so I did one just the other day, and almost every card came back: housing, affordable housing, homelessness. To me, the ability to create more affordable housing, the ability to make sure that people don't have to work three jobs to afford the house, that's important. And it's kind of a for me, something that I want to work on, because I know the impact of a good, clean, safe place. To me, building generational wealth is part of it, as part of home ownership. So I feel housing is an area that we want to tackle head on.
That's Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, we learn more about the rebirth of the recently closed Creative Vision Factory in Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this year, contributor Larry Nagengast reported on the circumstances that prompted the Creative Vision Factory to close its former Wilmington location in June, ending over a decade of work using art to help those facing homelessness, mental health issues, and addiction. This week, Larry returns with the story of the Creative Vision Factory's rebirth at a new site with a new name and a slightly altered mission. That piece is available at DelawarePublic.org. And Larry recently joined me to discuss his reporting on how it all came together. So before we look ahead, let's do a quick look back. Sure. The Creative Vision Factory closed in June. What prompted that, and what was lost when it did shut down?
Well, it was a combination of factors that started coming to a head late last year. The Creative Vision Factory's contract with the state was due to end on this June 30th, and there was a lot of uncertainty about whether it would be granted a new contract, and if so, how much funding it would receive. Even if a new contract was awarded, there was still no assurance that it would include sufficient funds to cover the rent at the location on Shipley Street. At the same time, with continued construction of high-rent apartments on the surrounding blocks, the Creative Vision Factory staff and its clients, you know, who are men and women in various stages of recovery from addiction or mental illness, mostly unemployed and very often homeless, were feeling less and less comfortable in the neighborhood. So, Michael Kalmbach, the program's founder and director for 13 years, made the difficult decision to close the site and seek an alternative means of operating a peer support program that had a focus on the arts.
And as the Creative Vision Factory's time was winding down, it did in fact find a lifeline with Impact Life, offering some hope. What is Impact Life and what does it do?
Well, Impact Life is a larger social services organization that has operations throughout Delaware, plus a few in Maryland, and it focuses on assisting individuals in recovery from drug addictions. Kalmbach negotiated a merger this spring with Impact Life, with the Creative Vision Factory essentially becoming a program under Impact Life's umbrella. But it was not clear where it would be located. There was talk at the time of possibly moving to Ellesmere or even as far away as Newark, and whether it could continue to serve the approximately 100 people who were visiting the Shipley Street site every day.
So now, as part of that umbrella work of Impact Life, the group is morphing the Creative Vision Factory into something new, the Wilmington Recovery Cafe. Can you tell us what the basic model is here?
Well, the Wilmington Recovery Cafe is going to offer the same supports that the Creative Vision Factory provided, giving folks in recovery a safe haven during the day, helping them find housing, find jobs, navigate the social services bureaucracy, and generally create pathways to a greater stability in their lives. But there's going to be a little bit more structure and certainly more support in the new arrangement. And that's because the operation is going to be integrated into the Impact Life infrastructure, and it's going to use this Recovery Cafe model, which is a national network of nearly 70 sites that follow recognized best practices to promote recovery, collaborate in training, mentoring, sharing materials, and so on. So it's going to be a lot like what it has been, and the arts aspect is going to continue, but it is going to be in a new location.
So you mentioned Michael Kalmbach, the CVF founder, who is now the director of the Wilmington Recovery Cafe. How important is it having him on board, and how has the transition been for him moving from something that he kind of created on his own to being under an umbrella of another organization?
Well, you know, in a peer-run recovery setting, it's far better to start with leaders who have experienced addiction and who understand how a successful program should work. And Michael Kalmbach fits that description very well. Also, most of Impact Life's employees are themselves in recovery, so they have a personal commitment to better themselves and everyone that they work with. However, that doesn't mean that the transition to a new program has been easy for Kalmbach. After all, you know, he was running a largely independent operation for 13 years, and that certainly wasn't an easy task, but now he's got to function within a new system, one that's a little bit more structured, has different rules, different procedures, but he's already seeing some of the benefits because, you know, as part of a larger team, he has not only more support available to him on a day-to-day basis, but he's also got more colleagues that he can reach out to try to create enhanced program, do more things that he's always wanted to do.
So let's talk a little bit more about what kind of programming specifically the Recovery Cafe will offer. And you mentioned there's going to be some aspects of the Creative Vision Factory involved, but how will it differ from that? And will any of the CVS model really be incorporated in what we see at this new operation?
Well, you know, I think you can say it's going to be the same, but different. You know, as I said, all of the support services that Creative Vision Factory had offered will be offered at the Recovery Cafe. An area is going to be set up as an art studio, which was one of the Creative Vision Factory's greatest attractions. But the Recovery Cafe model is a little bit more structured than the way Kalmbach managed the CVF. The difference is something that he describes as, quote, loving accountability, unquote. Recovery Cafe members must be sober when they're in the building. No sleeping is allowed. Members have to attend a group session, which is called a recovery circle, once a week, and they have to do some service work, doing things like cleaning up or making coffee. Now, a lot of these things were things that the clients at the Creative Vision Factory were doing, but now it's going to be more structured, and they're going to be keeping track of what the participants are doing and how they're contributing to the program. Now, beyond the art studio, programming is going to evolve as membership grows, and it's going to be based on members' interests, Kalmbach says. Some of the things that he mentioned, yoga and meditation groups, gardening, writing workshops. He hopes to build collaborations with entities like the Woodlawn Library and some of the nearby museums. Members will also have opportunities to share their skills, and community members are going to be invited to come in and lead special interest groups as well.
So with all those things you just mentioned in mind, the kind of the neighbors and the community, how does this new location on Union Street in Wilmington compare to the old location closer to downtown? Does it address some of the issues CVF was feeling at its old spot that you mentioned earlier?
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, the new location is actually a former funeral home, and it's significantly larger than the former storefront on Shipley Street. There'll be a check-in area near the door, and then it'll be a fairly large cafe area, and then on the right, an arts area. And throughout the building, there's going to be ample space for smaller groups to congregate. We were talking about possible sessions for writers groups or yoga or meditation, whatever. There will be a place for that. Upstairs, they've got office space, and out in the back, there's an area outside that could be turned to a garden. Now, this Union Street neighborhood where the facility is going to be located, it's a mix of retail and dining options and residential, and there are very nearby landmarks like the Woodlawn Library, the West End Neighborhood House, St. Francis Hospital, all these things just a few blocks away. So far, the neighbors have been very welcoming.
One of the things we had talked about previously with this issue was, will a new location be able to serve the previous CVF regulars? Is there a sense if this location fits that bill?
It's a good question, and the answer is we're not quite sure yet. Now, Michael Kalmbach he's seen many of his former Creative Vision Factory clients. Some of them are finding refuge in the library, but many of them are still spending time on the streets. Now, the people he has talked to are eager to have someplace to go, a new safe space, but he's not sure how many of them are actually going to find their way over to Union Street.
And you noted earlier, this is not necessarily a new model. It has been used elsewhere and seems to be one that can be replicated, correct?
Yes, that's right. And that's an advantage of being a participant in this Recovery Cafe network. There's training, there's software for managing members, there are ways of sharing experiences, learning from others. And there are other Recovery Cafe affiliates in Delaware. Impact Life just opened a new site in Georgetown that's on its way to getting cafe certification, and it plans to open another one soon in Seaford. In Dover, an organization called Network Connect has partnered with an affiliate of Highmark Healthcare, and they're partnering to sponsor a cafe that opened in Dover in late July.
So what is the timetable for the Wilmington Recovery Cafe getting fully up and running?
Well, the cafe is actually now in a soft opening mode. That started the week before Labor Day, and limited weekday hours are going to continue through the grand opening, which is scheduled for September 24th. After that, the cafe is going to be open on weekdays from 9 to 5, and for shorter hours on weekends as well, which is an improvement over Creative Vision Factory, which was strictly a Monday through Friday operation. Evening hours are also a possibility, but that's something that they're not going to consider until everybody settles into their regular operations and gets acclimated. I talked to Erin Booker, who's the chairman of the board of Impact Life, and one of the things that she said at a town hall meeting with neighbors last month is, this is a safe space, and if you come in here, we're going to find a way to meet your needs. No one will be turned away.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the rebirth of the Creative Vision Factory as the Wilmington Recovery Cafe is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, Arts Playlist, and a conversation with the new executive director of the Biggs Museum of American Art. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover has a new executive director. Hassan Najjar, whose career in the arts spans roughly two decades, takes the reins at the Biggs after previously serving as the head of the Foothills Arts Center in Golden, Colorado. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Najjar for a chat about his background in the arts and his vision for the Biggs.
Take us back to when you were still in Colorado at the helm of the Foothills Arts Center in Golden, where you spent nearly a decade, if I'm not mistaken. Why did you decide to leave the Foothills Arts Center then and take on this role at the Biggs all the way over on the East Coast in Dover here in Delaware? What went into that decision? What did that thought process look like for you?
If I said that I like the beach, is that a good answer?
We'll take it.
You know, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to be a part of growing this institution into the organization that it should be, and just figuring out how to better serve the community's needs through the arts. I was able to do that in Colorado at Foothills. And when I saw this opportunity come up, it just seemed like a no-brainer to come and try to work some of that magic here. I've got a very capable staff, a very lively community here. I think thinking about how the arts contribute to a community's well-being, a community's mental health, contributes to even just the economy. This seemed like a really great location to make those advances.
So kind of piggybacking off of what you just said then, you've only just started as the executive director of the Biggs. This is your first week, but you know, you've been around. I mentioned the Foothills Arts Center before, but before that, you were the executive director of the Museum Center at Five Points in Cleveland, Tennessee, not Ohio, Cleveland, Tennessee. And you've been in the arts for roughly, two decades now. So, you know, what kind of considerations do you have? Again, piggybacking off what you just said, what kind of considerations do you have when you're interested in joining an organization like the Biggs? How do you assess if it's a good fit for you and you're a good fit for the Biggs and this region of the country and the community?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Kyle, I think it's one of those things where you're trying to see what the appetite for growth and change is, trying to figure out, during this process, what the needs are, and is that cultural institution poised to meet those needs? And so anytime I can come in and help a community get stronger through the arts, to me, that is very soul satisfying. I know some people who are, who have jobs and they work that 9 to 5 and they're, they go in, they punch the clock and then they get home and, they have hobbies and, that they do to kind of forget about work. But I'm a little bit different. I really love working in the arts. I find it very fulfilling, very passionate about it. And I've seen the change that cultural institutions can make in communities. And when I look at the Biggs and I see all the potential here, that's very exciting to me.
Well, let's talk a bit about your vision, for lack of a better word, your vision for the Biggs then. This is a fairly esoteric question, but how do you think your approach, your ideas, your general leadership, management style, just how you think about things, how do you think all of what you bring to the table can or will impact the museum and shape it going forward, and, you know, potentially grow it as you guide it through a planned expansion?
You know, it's tough to say. It's day two for me on the job as right. we speak today. And I know that thinking about my leadership style and how I like to engage people is very collaborative. You know, it's not one of those kind of field of dreams model. If you build it, they will come. We have to, you know, I've got to get myself ingrained into the community. You know, I've got to meet the people that are here, got to figure out what their needs are, figure out how they want to be engaged, what they're looking for in an art center. Some people don't even know how to answer that because they've never been in an art center or a museum. And so it's trying to meet people where they are. And so as we move forward, and I work with the board and the staff here at the Biggs, it's really just trying to answer those questions and then creating programs, exhibitions, and opportunities to basically meet those needs.
Well, that's the perfect segue, dovetail into my next question then. What about reaching audiences that have historically been difficult to bring into the fold then? How do you plan to incorporate younger and more diverse audiences into things, you know, based off of your past experiences? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, you just invite them to the table and ask them to help plan with you. I don't think it's rocket science. When you're trying to find folks that you want to be of service to, you just ask those folks what they want. it's a strange paradox, you know, that we have between for profits and nonprofits and any business out there who's profitable will create something based on an audience need, and nonprofits and cultural organizations should operate no differently. What are our audience's needs? And then let's create based on that. And if we don't know what those needs are, we go find those audiences and we ask them. And so there's no wizardry or magic to this. It's what businesses have been doing since the beginning of time.
Is there something about stepping into a role like this in the context of the Biggs? Is there something that is like a most difficult sort of thing? Is like, what are the most pressing areas for you right now? Again, knowing that it's, you know, only your first week, but is it programming, reflecting the community needs? Is it just getting out into the community and like meeting them where they're at and just, you know, learning more about them? What about
that? Yeah, it's all of the above, really. I mean, it's drinking from the fire hose. It's trying to figure out, what our role currently is. What do they perceive about us? You know, how accessible are we as an organization? And so it's really just learning all of that. And then for me personally, just finding ways to get out and meet folks and talk. Anywhere that I've been so far, we've been here for a week now in Delaware. I went to go get my haircut, and I asked the barber, like, hey, what do you know about the Biggs? And they talked about this Comic-Con event they were at last year and raved about it. I'm like, oh, that's amazing. Have you been back since? No. Why not? So it's just me really just having conversations with people when I'm out and about in the community. We were at getting a library card this past Friday, and I met someone who was a former volunteer here, and then they had some things to say. So it's just having conversations. And so really that's what I'm going to be doing. If anyone wants to get in touch with me, Hassan@thebiggsmuseum.org, shoot me an email. I'd love to hear about what you think about the Biggs. Reach out, because that's really what I'm going to be trying to find out over the next couple weeks here.
A true grassroots effort. I know there are plans to close out the year with a real blockbuster of an exhibit coming up by the so-called renowned artist Raziel, which I've also heard pronounced Raziel. But in terms of other programming, Hassan, the museum's expansion, et cetera, what should we be on the lookout for from the Biggs in the near future?
Oh, man, I think just at this point, with this being my first week, Hard to say. I think it's going to be looking at community engagement and programming and how we can bring people in, basically how we can be a magnetic institution. And when I say magnetic, it's how can we attract people in through the doors to take advantage of what we're offering. And if we're not offering what people want, how can we do that? So I think that's, that's going to be my answer right now. Ask me in a couple months, and I'll have a different answer for you altogether. But for now, it's community engagement.
Thanks to Biggs Museum of American Art Executive Director Hassan Najjar and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a look at how the University of Delaware is using AI in classrooms this fall. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. AI has impacted many aspects of life in recent years, but maybe none more than how we teach and learn. At the University of Delaware, the Academic Technology Services team is using AI this fall to turn thousands of instructor transcripts and lectures into interactive study tools like practice quizzes and flashcards. For this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with Erin Sicaranza and Giovanna Harris of UD's Academic Technology Services team to learn more about how the university is using AI.
Erin, I understand all of this started about a year and a half ago, we'll call it roughly 18 months. So this pilot has been in the making for some time. But let's back it up a bit because I'm curious, when you and your team started brainstorming how AI could support student outcomes, what were your original thoughts there, and why did you and your team feel it was necessary to use AI as a positive tool in this context?
So, great question. I would say a lot of it really came about because Giovanna recognized the value in the data that we have been storing for a lot of years. So we've got a vast repository of recorded video class lectures and the transcripts that go with them. So there's a lot of data there that's just been sitting and really unused and untapped for the better part of almost 20 years. And she recognized that with machine learning and generative AI, we now have the capability to take that text and transform it into something that students can engage with interactively. That was not possible to do with course data, which is very complex academic data that, it's now made possible because of these generative AI tools. And it was her recognition of that that sort of sparked some curiosity and playing around with. And so, yes, the project's been in existence for about a year and a half, but the idea for it came shortly after ChatGPT unveiled itself in that November of 22, I think it was. And really, she was just playing with it on the weekends and saying, I think this will work, right? So, okay, let's play with it and see where it stumbles. And we kind of stumbled into a real project, and it's been gaining steam, and it's been really, really fun and very productive.
When it comes to this specific use, it sounds like the data really informed it here, but were there any other uses in terms of what you settled on? Was there anything else that was considered?
So I can feel that real quick.
Yeah, because I think it has evolved a lot.
Yeah. So for us, this is the beginning and foundation, this particular use case, but we are considering other use cases. One of the primary highlights is that this is a faculty opt-in. So when the faculties are deciding that, yes, please use this data to help students be able to use AI safely and help me also to get more familiar with AI, they're also realizing that, hey, I have my own data that I may be able to use for my own benefit. For example, maybe they taught one subject or topic most of the semester as opposed to the second time they taught it. To be able to do comparative data on like test scores, how you're teaching, what topics you're covering for how long, for them to be able to refine their own teaching strategies is something that they're very interested in. But for right now, we're saying we're going to do this kind of walled garden approach where the AI is involved, but is the faculty expertise that is the highlight of it in their own data. And then the students feel comfortable because they know that this has all been reviewed by the faculty themselves.
Aaron, we'll turn to you here. When you zoom out and think about it from a 50,000 foot view, and Jordan, you feel free to chime in here. Is there a way you'll measure if this pilot is successful? And part two here, what is the ultimate goal? Is it really just to support students and even staff in a sense, or is there more to it in terms of how it affects academics and the academic experience and, you know, the overall outcomes?
Probably a little bit of all of that. I will say that really our primary driver in the beginning was we have access to this data. Let's use it for student success. Allow our students to, you know, we've got a population of students who they're sort of a kiosk generation, right? They don't have to go to a faculty member's office during office hours and then instead go onto a system and click a button to study at any hour. That's the generation of students we're dealing with. So I think giving them the tools that are personalized and helping them to advocate for their own study habits, that's sort of where this started. What it has since grown into is this ability to sort of shape how AI is being used in higher ed more broadly, really layering on. We were very intentional from the outset on coming up with ethical principles. And I learned that the hard way when I first started talking about this project and accessed all these data. People were like, oh my God, you're scraping UD Capture. How do I opt out? Right. So I'm like, no, that's not what we're doing. So I learned the hard way how to talk about, you know, we are very principled. It is all being done ethically and responsibly. And so we have documentation that we, from the outset of this project, here's why we're doing it, here's our mission, et cetera. So that became an important part of this process. And it has allowed us now to expand our collaborations. We're collaborating with AWS, Amazon Web Services, for some of the technical piece. So looking at industry partners, but also higher ed networks, where, you know, Giovanni and I have gone and spoken about this project in lots of different ways to other institutions, and there's a lot of interest. And so having a say in shaping how other universities think about their own data has become an important part of that more recently. So,
yeah, collaboration is something that we've really been intentional about in the beginning. Not just with other higher education institutions, but also with our librarians, with their disability studies. We've contacted our philosophers. We've contacted our own computer science faculty. That's what we were saying, that in higher education, we're uniquely positioned to have all these expertise. And we all have the same goal, which is student success. So it's very unlike a for-profit corporation. It is something where collaboration is encouraged, and we have this wealth of knowledge and resources. So for us to be able to not only dive deep into what does it really mean to be ethical, and ask the librarians to come give a little presentation for us or to collaborate on one part, and for us to say, we're doing this project. Does anyone want to collaborate and do research on the outcomes? Does anyone want to help with workshopping what students may want for learning objects? We have instructional designers in our team who will be helping you do prompt engineering for faculty for their own data. Like, so all this collaboration is something that's making this project really impactful.
Looking ahead, do you have like a vision for how this looks in when it's expanded and used at a broader scale at UD?
We sure do. Do you want to touch this one?
So one of the things that is really a passion of mine and of ours, I think, is we have access to this technology that's great. But also we are teaching new generations about ethics and what to expect with this technology. And AI allows us to assimilate a bunch of data and make it human readable. So now if a student has access to their own data and is able to extrapolate on trends, on statistics, what does that mean for their own learning? So there's a way to give advocacy back to the student for their learning. So for right now, you know, we can do this with courses, but what if there's other university things that we can use that allows students to be able to have their access to their own data and help with their own learning? Let's say their grades are starting to drop and it's like, oh, I want to know what learning objects should I have access to, or how do I seem to learn best? As opposed to last year, I was able to ace these courses. This year, maybe not so much. What are some trends that you're seeing? So having the ability for university data and student data to be able to talk to each other while having transparency of what that looks like, I think is something I'm really excited about.
And I would say from my perspective, one of the things that has been really fulfilling for me is to build the skills and expertise in-house through this project, right? So now we've got a big set of skills in-house to help think about, you know, what this could look like in 5 years.
Thanks to Erin Sicaranza and Giovanna Harris of UD's Academic Technology Services team and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast, our Canada Conversations producers Ethan Grandin, Jeet Hanslin, and Robert Stice, and Delaware Public Media's senior producer Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.